Chapter 3. The German Dynamo. The average person in the West, whether European, American, or what have you, has long taken for granted that Kaiser Wilhelm II bears the chief responsibility for the First World War. After all, at the end of the war, it was so otherwise reasonable a man as Britain's Prime Minister David Lloyd George, who, with victory in sight, announced that he and his allies would hang the Kaiser. Later Lloyd George would promise the House of Commons that the imperial culprit would first be driven through the streets of London in an iron cage, a promise which enabled him to win the elections of February 1919 handily. Although Lloyd George and the mobs he appealed to, as well as Britain's allies and the revolutionary successors to Wilhelm's rule in Germany were cheated of their desire, Wilhelm's reputation was effectively hanged by the war propaganda of the day, and has remained on the gallows thanks to the writings of establishment historians. Such has been the stultifying effect of this propaganda that, although large numbers of people still believe the German Emperor to have been a particularly baneful species of ogre, not one person in a thousand knows anything of Kaiser Wilhelm's actions in those times. The impression remains that 8 million men died in the abattoirs of Flanders and Galicia thanks to the Kaiser alone. The Versailles Treaty, which affirmed Germany's sole guilt for the war, could never have been imposed, of course, without the central thesis of Wilhelm II's villainy. One doubt about Wilhelm's alleged war plotting and the whole fraudulent document would lose its force. In fact, what role did Wilhelm II play in the outbreak of the war? Truth to tell, on the day Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, the Kaiser hadn't been in Germany for days. He was still sailing the North Sea on his yacht Hohenzollern, a contented vacationer. Notified of the crime at Sarajevo, he had expressed his horror and assured Emperor Franz Joseph of his full support. Nevertheless, at the time he viewed the affair as merely a local one, in which Austria-Hungary, deprived of its heir to the throne and its army commander-in-chief in one stroke, had an understandably legitimate concern. Still unaware of what the Austrians would learn in their interrogation of the assassins, the Kaiser departed at the beginning of July, determined to spend the entire month at sea. Had that impulsive ruler really wished to ignite a European war, he surely would have paid more attention to putting his plans in motion. But he allowed his chief of staff, von Moltke, to continue his stay at Carlsbad, while Admiral Tirpitz, commander of the navy, whiled away his leave at Terespe. Why, in any case, would Germany and its leader want war? By 1914, Germany had achieved economic preeminence on the continent without firing a shot. As the French historian Lévis remarked in an address delivered at the Sorbonne in April, 1917, referring to the years between 1871 and 1914, at no time in history have we seen such a stupendous growth in work and wealth in any country in so little time. Since 1870, Germany's population had increased by 15 million people, while England held steady and France stagnated. The Germans no longer had to emigrate, for the country's prodigious growth provided work for all. The coal output had nearly doubled in the years between 1900 and 1910. The German metallurgical, chemical, and precision instrument industries were the best in the world. Everywhere German products commanded admiration, and its exports had doubled between 1910 and 1913, reaching a total of 10 billion marks in that year. These goods traveled to far-off places, China and the Americas, in German ships, for the merchant marine had entered the era of its greatest expansion, and the imperial colors waved over the seven seas. German expansion was all the more impressive in that it was carried out in several decades without military conquest, a remarkably pacific expansion, and compared to the bloody rise of such imperial powers as Britain and France, not to mention America, which gained its share of territory from Mexico. The quality of Germany's product and the efficiency of German commercial agents won fearful jealousy, especially among the lords of British imperialism. As the eminent French historian Pierre Renouvin testified, from 1900 on, Germany has had marked success. Thanks to the initiative of her commercial travelers, who endeavor to be aware of the new needs of their customers and to satisfy their tastes, and thanks to the easy terms that the exporters offer to their buyers, German commerce is in the process of taking the lead over British commerce in Holland, where Rotterdam is in effect an appendage of the Rhineland, in Belgium, where part of the business of Antwerp is in the hands of 40,000 Germans, in Italy, which buys metallurgical and chemical products from Germany, in Russia, where the Germans have the advantage of proximity and better knowledge of the country, and even in Serbia. The margin of superiority that the British trade has in the markets of France, Spain, and the Ottoman Empire is constantly diminishing. The English producer and exporter is annoyed at everywhere coming up against these German tradesmen who do them out of a sale. The economic rivalry fosters a bad climate in public opinion that cannot fail to have an effect on political relations. Le Crise Européenne, page 142. Until then, the seas had been the almost private domain of the British Empire for two centuries, world commerce a British monopoly throughout the 19th century. Both Spain and France had been soundly thrashed for failing to accede to Britain's supremacy with good grace. Philip II of Spain and France's Napoleon had seen their dreams sunk along with their fleets by the Royal Navy. Wilhelm II, by having the audacity to construct a merchant fleet able to service 70% of Germany's overseas trade, called forth the wrath of an arrogant monopoly, which 20 years later even Hitler would shrink from antagonizing. The Queen of England expressed the establishment's view when she complained that William II is playing at Charlemagne. For the most part, the British leadership was reluctant to give vent to its misgivings at the rise of Germany's industry and fleet. The Germans, for their part, cherished the hope that they could arrange matters with the British in some kind of gentleman's agreement. The British response, however, was not encouraging, particularly on the matter of German colonial expansion to siphon off some of its burgeoning population. Every such effort was jealously opposed by Great Britain. Small neighbors such as Belgium or Holland could possess huge empires 60 or 80 times the size of the metropolitan territory. After all, they had long been considered to be Britain's dutiful satellites. Germany was a powerful rival. That to effectively compete with the rising German economy required nothing more than that the United Kingdom manufacture products as well made and as inexpensive as those of the Reich was lost on the British. Challenged, they felt threatened. Solitary, haughty, and brusque, the British set about looking for allies against the German menace. In 1904, Britain began a rapprochement with her hereditary enemy, France, when both nations had concluded the Entente Cordiale, which in reality would always remain the Mésentente Cordiale. Nevertheless, the fact that the ponderous John Bull and the light-limbed Marianne had opened the dance marked a turning point in history. It would take the double disaster for the British establishment of two disastrous world wars in this century to drive home the recognition that its world monopoly had at last ended, superseded by the uneasy condominium of the United States of America and the Soviet Union. Despite an abortive British offer of Portuguese Angola to Germany in exchange for their discontinuing the build-up of their fleet, made in 1912, Wilhelm II refused to be dissuaded, and the shipwrights continued their work. This didn't mean that the Kaiser was striving for war, however. Indeed, in 1905 he concluded a fraternal agreement with his erstwhile Russian rival the Tsar, on his own initiative, while vacationing on his yacht off Denmark. The Tsar was by nature a gentle soul, dripping with good intentions. But he was weak-willed and neurotic, and he was constantly surrounded by a guard of Pan-Slav activists, bellicose grand dukes, and shadowy wire-pullers and manipulators of all sorts. Despite Wilhelm's intent to draw France into his cordial understanding with Russia, interests inimical to a Russian-German détente around the Tsar succeeded in torpedoing the agreement within 4 months. The anti-German Franco-Russian Entente of 1894 continued in force, and the Russian imperialists eyed Bohemia, in Austria-Hungary, and Galicia more greedily than ever. For their part, the French, bolstered by the hope of the support of Russia's massive army, schemed to retake Alsace-Lorraine.